Welcome into the Ether, a podcast focusing on all things Ethereum, the leading blockchain for decentralized applications. I'm Eric Connor, your host and founder of ETHub, a decentralized information hub for Ethereum. Into the Ether features deep dives on topics with prominent guests in the community, as well as ETHub weekly recaps featuring Anthony Sisano. Hello, everyone, and welcome into the Ether. My guest today needs no introduction, as I have the founder of Ethereum, Vitalik Buterin, on the podcast. How's it going today, Vitalik?
That's good. Thank you. How are you?
Good, good. Thanks for joining me. I want to structure today's talk as a bit of a journey from where we are today with Ethereum into where we're headed. Let's go ahead and start with your role in Ethereum. I've noticed it's kind of morphed a little bit over time. I would say it's a bit noticeable that you've taken a step back in some decision making over the past year, especially around things like the issuance reduction. Is this something you've consciously decided, and how would you define your role today?
And I've definitely consciously decided not to step into these like issuance reduction and proc pow discussions too deeply, and both because I think the community does need to have the practice in just making decisions by itself and not kind of following the leader, and at this point the leader probably includes not just myself but also honestly even like core Ethereum Foundation people and developers. I think the thing that is still important for me to be doing is working on the Ethereum 2.0 protocol and also on other key research areas that we've been focusing on over the last couple of years, basically just kind of helping getting the spec to something close to completion, getting it to the point where clients can develop something and make test nets, help all of them along with their journeys, help with some of the decisions that need to be made on the 2.0 side, and it's like all of that by itself is still like there's a lot of stuff involved in that, and like honestly, as much as people love like arguing about things like issuance reductions and proc pow, like at most it's maybe an extra 1 to 2 million ETH being allocated or redirected. Like whichever way the outcome goes, it's not a make or break Ethereum sort of thing. Whereas proof of stake and sharding being successful is and also not a make and break Ethereum kind of thing. I mean, if they never happens, then 1.x and Plasma and so forth could do great things, but it's still something that has a much larger impact. So that's something that I think just needs a lot of attention, and it's also just personally something that like I think is very interesting and rewarding and valuable to work on, because actually trying to create a scalable proof of stake blockchain on this scale is definitely not something that's even been attempted before.
Yeah, definitely. No, I think it's been a good transition. I mean, early on, I think you kind of need that leading voice to kind of, you know, push the protocol at launch. And then kind of as time goes on, I like the approach that the community's been stepping up and other developers taking lead on 1.x and 2.0 and stuff like that. And we're definitely going to dive pretty heavily into 2.0 because I know that's where a lot of your effort's been recently. But on the current status of Ethereum, I mean, what's your take on the current status? Is it kind of where you envision it would be? Yeah, I mean, now it's been while 4 years into the mainnet or so, is it kind of where you thought it would be at this point?
I'm not sure what I even thought it would be 4 years ago, honestly. Like even just the sheer scale of the Ethereum ecosystem and like the crypto space in general has kind of continued exceeding my expectations every time one of these bubbles happens. It's like 5 years ago I was not expecting, you know, Microsoft and Opera and HTC and Samsung and so forth, like building Ethereum things. I was not expecting the community to kind of reach just the sheer scale that it has now. So that's something that's like honestly caught me by surprise, like, as much as it's caught a lot of other people by surprise. In terms of kind of emphasis, I remember like back in early 2014, like the really, really original vision, right? I came up with Ethereum after spending some time working on Mastercoin and realizing that, you know, hey, you can do a lot more if instead of just having these like five different Swiss Army knife features, you have this highly general purpose programming language that controls money. And then from there, the discussion moved on to kind of Web3 and all of those other things. And now with all of these things like Augur and Maker and, you know, Uniswap and decentralized exchanges succeeding so well, it feels like it's done a little bit of a full circle back into this kind of open finance direction that it didn't have the name, but it's basically what it was 5 years ago. So that's definitely been something that's interesting to watch. Though, and I don't think that that's a kind of infinitely long trend. Like, I think other things are going to start popping up and they're just taking longer because there's more stuff you have to build before anything interesting comes out of them.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with that. And one interesting thing about the open finance movement is, you know, it doesn't really rely on scalability. I mean, it would be a nice to have for sure, but I think that's kind of why we've seen the narrative shift there a little bit. I mean, you mentioned, you know, moving beyond open finance into new endeavors in the near future. Kind of where do you see us shifting after, you know, I would say a lot of the work's pretty focused on open finance now. Of course, we kind of have gaming and a lot of other stuff out there, but what do you think the next kind of big endeavor is going to be?
Yeah, and a lot of people are talking about gaming, and like recently at a presentation, I asked the community what area of applications am I neglecting, and they basically said gaming is the first big answer. And the other big answer, by the way, was decentralized insurance, which is also interesting. But the and gaming is interesting not because like games are literally the most important thing in the world in terms of ultimate impact, but because it's a sector where a lot of the ideas around what blockchains can do and why they're valuable can kind of be tried and prove themselves out in a context that's still kind of ultimately completely virtual and so ultimately easier to work with for purely digital kind of tech like blockchains are. So, like, the basic pitch that I hear from these blockchain gaming projects is this idea that, you know, you have really big companies, and really big companies have their ecosystems, and they tend to be closed ecosystems, because if you're a big centralized monopoly, then closing stuff is what you do. And then there's all of these other smaller companies, and the smaller companies don't really have much of a network effect by themselves, and then like, people are more likely to kind of hop from one company to another, and so like there's more demand for them to be able to kind of share network effect by like basically creating this decentralized asset exchange where people can easily trade or in the long term possibly even move assets from one game to another game. So it's like it is something that people seem to want. So, like, people seem to want to, you know, be able to earn their gold fighting orcs and then trade their gold for Millennium Falcons and then use fly those Millennium Falcons around somewhere else, then teleport those Millennium Falcons into a Jurassic Park, use them to shoot up dinosaurs or whatever. And like it does genuinely sound really cool, interesting and cool. But the larger point here is that this kind of pitch that blockchains can help many little guys kind of hold their own against the big centralized monopolies is by basically building on top of common platforms is one that has a lot of impact beyond the gaming industry, and it's one that I've originally heard beyond the gaming industry. I actually originally heard it in the context of kind of finance and like fiat currency exchange and international remittances. So that if that's something that succeeds in one place, I could see it being tried in many others.
Yeah, definitely. And just having like in-game assets, you know, tokenized or being able to be truly owned and transferred, I think will be pretty powerful there too. Shift a little bit, still on current state of Ethereum, but you know, governance is a really hot topic. Like there's so much governance debate out there. There's at this point, it feels like years long Twitter threads that go back and forth about it. And, you know, a lot of projects coming out and talking about their on-chain governance. Kind of what's your take on the current governance in the blockchain space in general? And do you ever think Ethereum should consider any type of on-chain governance?
I actually think that like Ethereum governance is underrated at this point, because like it's not something that we can attach a cool name to and advertise. And all like honestly, kind of moderation is definitely a less exciting pitch for people than either, you know, on-chain vote every like maximum coin holder engagement, or on the other hand, immutability. And like we as a community have never tended to kind of go for extremes, but like if you in reality, right, like as my like on the one hand people complain about governance as a process, but on the other hand, like in terms of concrete outcomes that Ethereum governance has achieved, like it's done really well. Like people, it's implemented the issuance reductions, and the issuance reductions seem to be something most people agree with. It's looking to be moving toward toward proc pow, which seems to be something that many more people support than not. It's implemented all of the technical hard forks that it needed to. When there was a time of crisis back during the 2016 DOS attacks, it managed to implement, roll, like spec out, test, and roll out a hard fork all within a time span of 6 days. And that's not something we want to repeat, but it's clearly something we can do if we really wanted to. When there was a Constantinople bug, it managed to shut it, to delay the fork within a few hours. So, like, it is, I would say, like achieving the coin, the things that like you might reasonably want a governance of a protocol to achieve, which is basically to make changes that people want and not make changes that people don't want. Like the one thing that it's obviously not achieving is either like dispute resolution or fund recovery or like things in that category. And the other thing it's not achieving is like basically kind of decentralized funding of public good projects. But and I would probably claim there is a big chance that like just like even in at least in the first area, even opening the Pandora's box could easily just lead to more harm than good in terms of like endless bike shedding and like where do you draw the line and things like that. And in terms of decentralized funding of public goods, there's like the problem is that that sort of stuff, just especially in an anonymous context, is too easy to capture. Like it's fundamentally impossible to distinguish between a project which is a genuinely genuine public good, which 10,000 people that together make up 10% of the Ethereum stake find valuable, versus a project which just is a front for a donation heading straight into the pocket of a whale or an exchange that holds 10% of all the ether. Like in an anonymous context, you can't distinguish the two. And therefore, fundamentally, any governance system is going to either underfund public goods or it's going to just print money into the pockets of plutocrats. And I feel, as my prediction is, that the Ethereum community would prefer to kind of underfund public goods at protocol level and then kind of come up with ways as a community of remedying that, at least at this point. But I mean, these are like things that obviously could be kind of discussed and end up changing and so forth. In terms of on-chain governance, I actually feel my answer is like honestly an increasingly hard no. The reason basically being that like especially now Ethereum exists in a context of many other people providing alternatives, and there's, you know, Dfinity with its central nervous system, there's Nervous, there's Polkadot, there's Algorand, there's more and more of these platforms coming out. And one thing I noticed is that these platforms all seem to be moving in this kind of on-chain governance direction and advertising on-chain governance as a feature. And I would argue that there's definitely a legitimate clientele that wants and love those kinds of things, but there's also this large space of this large kind of region of what you could call political design space, where you don't do highly activist governance, you don't do on-chain governance, and you try to be something that's kind of in between being Bitcoin-y and doing everything that technically makes sense. And when you need to innovate, you try to focus the innovation on layer two when you can. And that's obvious, focus innovation on layer two is obviously something that people have said to defend layer ones that I would claim are kind of insufficient to actually build the layer twos. But once you have proof of stake and once you have sharding and scalable data availability, then the kinds of things that you can do is just building layers of abstraction on top of the protocol actually really expands a lot. And the properties that those kinds of protocols have really expands a lot. And I actually made a presentation about this in Taipei literally yesterday, and I'd be happy to send the slides. I have them right here. But basically think of high-level programming languages, things like ZK Rollup, things like the proposal I have for speeding up cross-shard transactions. The more, once you have even just a scalable data layer, the kinds of things that you can do is just expands by a lot. And the need that you have to modify the base layer actually decreases really significantly. And so I think trying to value stability more than some of these other newer platforms in the long term is probably something that the Ethereum community would probably do best by kind of moving towards. But this is something that I definitely want to kind of see more community discussion around.
Yeah, I agree with that. I talk a lot on the podcast. I'm not a big fan of on-chain governance. I find it a bit odd that a lot of these projects use it as a marketing gimmick, but I get why they do it. Gimmick's maybe not the right word, but marketing tactic to a point. Mm-hmm. And I do agree that, Ethereum seems to work. What's funny is I'm not really sure how I would describe it works or why it works, but it does seem to so far, and there's no real name for it. So that's maybe why people misunderstand it and don't talk about it enough. But I feel like to this point, it's working well. But I guess it's always healthy to kind of have these discussions regardless.
Yeah. Did you read the post I made with Glenn on central planning as overfitting, by the way?
I did actually. Yeah. But do you want to explain it?
I made the distinction, it was really Glenn who actually who wrote that part, but he made the distinction between redundant complexity and optimizing complexity, where optimizing complexity is the kind of complexity that you might see in some really fancy machine with 500 different moving parts, each of which has their own totally different purpose, and if any one of them break, the whole thing crashes to a halt. But redundant complexity would be things like common law, where you have a lot of different concepts, but they're kind of highly overlapping. They kind of evolved over time, many hundreds of years. And even though it feels complex, for reasons that Glenn managed actually describes really well with his appeals to VC dimension and statistics, doesn't kind of fail terribly the same way that that optimizing complexity does. And I feel like Ethereum's kind of quote vague governance has moved in that kind of direction a bit.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I feel like, I guess I would almost describe it. I feel like the Ethereum community has almost created antibodies for things that would completely crush it. I think at this point, a large state change or fund recovery, right, would be bad. That's my personal opinion. So things like on the extreme, the governance process would handle, and kind of what you were just talking about, and you mentioned earlier, the issuance reduction. I personally feel strongly that the issuance reduction from 3 to 2 was good, because I think we need strong economics on the base layer. But if it didn't go in, would it be the end of the chain? No, it wouldn't, right? So it's interesting to think about the extremes and kind of where governance falls in the middle of that spectrum.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Yeah. So you mentioned funding a little bit. I was going to talk about it later, but since you mentioned it, I'd like to bring it up. Do you worry at all about us being able to fund development on Ethereum into the future? I'm not talking like next year or 2 years from now, but say, you know, 5-10 years down the road. If you were forced to kind of pick an option for funding, either on the core protocol level or through some kind of like opt-in from miners or validators, what do you think you would pick?
It's definitely a kind of challenge. I mean, in the short term, I think it's definitely like not something we have to worry about for a while, as you mentioned, because the Ethereum Foundation is well funded. A lot of the bigger companies in the space are well funded. The Ethereum Foundation is definitely, I know as an insider, spending its money quite responsibly, and it's trying not to err in the direction of like burning its stash within the next 1 to 2 years and then saying what next. Now in the long run, I mean, I guess first of all, it depends on just what level of kind of public goods provision we want, because it is theoretically possible to run a scalable blockchain on a budget of a few million dollars a year. And that's and if we're just talking about a few million dollars a year, then it may well be that, say, the Ethereum Foundation's budget can just possibly like plus budgets of a couple of other big entities can just cover that forever. But if we want to do something that's more expansive, then it would. So like, for example, you know, we would want a lot of development going into layer twos. We would want like a lot of things like security audits and improvements, client optimizations for layer one, like a lot of work into Starks and all of these other things. Then, and there's a couple of options. Some like voluntary donation based thing could definitely be provide kind of some of the impact. And I actually suggested like on Twitter a few days ago that idea that we have this norm that, you know, wallet providers like should kind of charge a fee of like up to one Gwei for transactions going through their platform, and we should all kind of agree to be okay with that. Which like one Gwei, as I mentioned, it increases the amount of transaction fees that people pay by 7%, but it raises $2 million a year for wallet development. So that's one option. But then if that also ends up being insufficient, like if everything ends up being insufficient, then pretty much the only option would be like some kind of inflation funding. And I'm actually interested in any kind of cautiously watching Zcash as an alternative, because the Zcash community seems to have very similar values to Ethereum in a lot of cases, but they are willing to be somewhat more aggressive in terms of somewhat more centralized decision making. And one of those things is that they basically have this off-chain, like this, like almost kind of Vlad Zamfirian governance thing that is deciding on where 20% of the Zcash inflation pool is going. And so far it's been going to a combination of the Zcash Foundation and some other developers. And like, I know that they're interested in kind of doing more things with that. Now, I personally would be opposed to a pool that goes straight into one particular centralized organization, but like the compromise that might see more support in favor of it is doing something like that, but pumping the reward into some, like say some CLR gadget, something like Gitcoin, and then you still have a kind of half decentralized mechanism that actually does the last mile and chooses like which specific public goods the funding would go into. So like basically I think it all depends on the range of like just how much funding we need to raise, and then at different levels there's sort of different levels in Well, there's different trade-offs that you can make to kind of both minimize intrusiveness to the status quo and maximize the ability to kind of actually fund things that we want to fund, as opposed to funding relatively useless things at each of those scales. But, and as I mentioned, like, it's definitely a discussion that doesn't need to happen even for the next few years.
Yeah, agreed. And the community seems pretty open to it. And I bet it's going to take a little time to find the right solution, but I think we'll get there. I mean, you mentioned Gitcoin, the CLR matching. We talk about them a lot. We've been trying to lead the Gitcoin Torch effort. And for the second round of matching, just for those unaware, Gitcoin, the Ethereum Foundation has put up $50,000 to matching in their round two of CLR effort. And I think we're up to $14,000 DAI for the community effort, which we're calling the Gitcoin Torch. So I agree. One of my favorites is to be able to direct funds there, and then it goes to projects that have gotten on Gitcoin grants and are out there to be able to accept funds. But yeah, I think that'll be a debate we'll have over the next year or two from the community and where we're going to go. But you know, I think it's important to set ourselves up for future sustainability, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I guess on future sustainability, I want to talk quickly about Ethereum 1.x effort before we move on to Ethereum 2.0. I had Alexei on the podcast two weeks ago, and we talked a lot about Ethereum 1.x, but especially state rent. So I guess for those that aren't aware, Ethereum 1.x is an effort to make sure the Ethereum main chain is sustainable into the future. And one of those core efforts is keeping the state size in check. So Vitalik, I just wanted to ask you kind of what's your current favorite state rent proposal? Does that involve stateless clients? Because I know Alexei was talking about his fourth proposal that'll come out soon that will involve stateless clients.
Sure. So there's two concrete categories of proposals. One of them is state rent, which basically says, you know, if you have a contract with some storage keys, you have to pay some amount of money per block, per storage key that you're filling. Otherwise, your contract disappears and you have to do some special transaction to wake it. The other kind of proposal is the stateless client approach, which basically says that we're going to replace every contract with a kind of stub of that contract. And by stub, I basically mean Merkle root. And then if you want to make a transaction that touches that contract, you have to provide the Merkle branches yourself. And that, like, both approaches are theoretically reasonable, but I mean, they are also kind of disruptive to existing applications, right? And we do need to take the fact that they're disruptive to existing applications seriously. And like, I actually think that we need to start like doing some kind of community polling work on like basically like what level of disruptiveness to the status quo is the community willing to tolerate. So this could be like things like polls, carbon votes, like whatever, but try to like both kind of gauge community opinion and kind of get legitimacy to this idea that like these proposals are going to like potentially break some existing things. So for example, like you can definitely come up with categories of contracts that work now that would not be able to work under either a state rent regime or a stateless client regime. But just communicating what those concrete costs are and like why those costs are worth paying. Now, the analysis that I did does show that in terms of disruptiveness, a state rent seems to be more disruptive than stateless clients, which is, I think, part of why MLXA is interested in the stateless client approach. Like basically, because with state rent, any application or any contract that allows third-party users to make a transaction that increases the number of storage keys that the contract stores, which is really a very wide class. Like it includes things like ERC-20 tokens. Like it even almost includes the Foundation multisig wallet. Then like all of those contracts become like vulnerable to griefing attacks. But with the stateless client proposal, the only thing that breaks is contracts that require dynamic state accesses. So accessing state where the thing you're accessing depends on like previous information that you've gathered from the contract that frequently changes. But like arguably the that seems kind of scary, but the good news is that there are countermeasures and there are kind of new ways to design contracts to get around the both of those issues. And I personally actually do think that going those costs are worth paying. And the reason is that like the amount of scalability gain and the amount of like blockchain usability and efficiency gain that we get from the state going down from the status quo to say something like 1 to 3 gigabytes is actually very, very significant. And that's, or possibly even less than 1 to 3 gigabytes. And I like potentially here we're talking about making it possible to increase the gas limit to 40 million, like if we potentially, if we can restructure the system so that its dependence on state is much lower, right? So like those costs, and the other reason why I think those costs are worth paying is that in Ethereum 2.0, we already know that, you know, we are going to be state minimizing and we are going to implement some form of state rent, and we are going to kind of encourage heavy reliance on stateless client-like approaches. So the work that people do in kind of redesigning their applications to make them sustainable in a 1.x model is work that they would have to do anyway as part of migrating to 2.0. So I think like it is definitely a kind of collective challenge to work through those details and to execute a transition to a rent-based model safely. But it is a, like it's a collective challenge that is kind of absolutely worth the benefits that we get coming out of the other side. But it is something that does, you know, require genuine kind of community buy-in, and it is something that the people pushing for it do need to kind of clearly make and explain the case for.
You know, on that point, when do you kind of become concerned about state size? Like, are you concerned about node sizes today? I mean, you know, I think a full parity node is about 170 gigabytes. Do you think at a point hardware costs will drop faster than this concern of state size growing?
I mean, I would say currently it's still a big issue. So like, for example, the laptop I bought has like 512 gigabytes of SSD. And then just because of like partitioning issues, you know, I have even less. And so just running a Geth node is definitely taking up a large portion of the laptop's hard drive. So I definitely think that it's, you know, an issue. And I definitely think that the people that claim it's not an issue because, you know, 10 terabyte hard drives theoretically exist are wrong about that. I also think that like it's not just about making the existing blockchain work better, it's about making it work better enough that we actually can do more aggressive things. So like I mentioned, raising the gas limit to 40 million. Currently raising the gas limit to 40 million is just totally not practical because the blockchain, like fast syncing would break quickly, the hard nodes would start to like actual full nodes would start taking up 2 terabytes pretty quickly, and like this, most of the state would not fit in RAM, and that would make access as slow, and all of those things would start happening. But on the other hand, you know, if we manage to control state size and we manage to do the other thing that Alexei wants to do, which is basically stop with this idea of every node storing the full history, and instead have every node only ran only possibly store small portions of history and use some different protocol for getting history beyond some fairly short period of time, then that also, if we can do those things, then that does enable the potentially significant scalability gains even on the current 1.0 Ethereum chain.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, going to 40 million obviously would increase our throughput by 5 times today. So that'd be a huge gain just on the main layer, which would be great.
Yeah, and the thing I wanted to mention also about the 40 million number is that if you look at uncle rates right now, the uncle rates are actually like pretty low, right? Even though blocks are 75% full, they're like under 10%. And if you try to like do an analysis or a linear regression or like whatever to... and of how much adding 1 million gas contributes to the uncle rate, it's like actually not that big a deal. So state size issues are at this point like literally the bottleneck in terms of like why we would not want to push gas limits up very significantly right now. So it definitely is something that there should be kind of all eyes on figuring out how to mitigate.
Yeah, that's a good way to frame it. I mean, it's really important because we could gain that throughput, but it kind of sets us back. So if we can figure out how to keep it in check, that'd be awesome. Yeah, I think that's a good transition to talking about throughput so we can finally move on to Ethereum 2.0. I know a lot of your effort recently has been on the research side of Ethereum 2.0, so I'd really like to talk about that. For those not fully aware or perhaps want to hear the description from you, can you provide a quick overview of what Ethereum 2.0 tries to accomplish?
Sure. So in two words, it's basically POS and sharding, right? Well, I would have said proof of stake and sharding, but proof of stake is three words. The basically proof of stake, you know, like this kind of big switch of the consensus algorithm away from relying on mining and computation and hardware to like basically locking up your ETH as a way of being a participant in the validation process. And that would make the chain kind of much more efficient. It would also reduce the required issuance rates very significantly. It would also enable some other kind of goodies on the side. So for example, we want to decrease the block time to about 6 seconds. So the 2.0 roadmap is kind of split up into a few stages where the first stage, what we call phase zero, does basically just creates a proof of stake chain. And there's nothing on the proof of stake chain. It's just the proof of stake chain supporting itself. Then phases one and two actually implement the sharding part, and sharding massively increases the scalability of the platform by basically setting it up so that instead of every node needing to verify every transaction, only a randomly selected small portion of nodes actually need to verify any specific piece of data. And so phase one implements sharding just for data. So you would have a chain that has about 2.8 megabytes a second of data throughput, but the data would not even like mean anything by itself. And then for phase two, that's the part where we actually bring in a state execution and contracts and like WebAssembly and virtual machines and Ether inside of shards and all of those other things.
Yeah, and on the phase two spec side, how close is that to completion? And do you have any kind of, I guess, hope or for an ETA on testnets?
Phase two is still pretty far away. Like, there's still a lot of decisions that need to be made. Phase zero is, like, very close to completion. And testnets are coming extremely soon. Phase one is kind of in the middle. Like, there is a version of the spec that's sitting there that is kind of theoretically sufficient and theoretically could be implemented and done as is. But there's also improvements that we want to make. And just about a week ago, Justin came up with a much more efficient proof of custody game. And then we also want to think about friendliness for multi-party computation and a bunch of other issues. But honestly, right now, most clients, I think, are focusing on getting phase zero to the testnet stage, and there hasn't been that much work done on phase one, with the exception of looking into peer-to-peer networking issues and of Wasm, which has been in the development process pretty much all along.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to the testnets on phase zero. So hopefully that's soon. I guess in talking about, you mentioned phase two will introduce state transition. So I guess for those that aren't aware, in phase zero and one, people that want to stake are able to send their ether over on a one-way bridge to in phase zero to be able to validate. So basically, to be a validator, you need 32 ether and you can start staking your ether and earn gains. There's been some concern I've seen in the community about this one-way bridge on ETH 2.0. I guess they're worried about having two different assets. So essentially, you're going to have Ether on the 1.0 chain. And then I describe it as almost like a bond. People are calling it Beacon Ether, but really you're kind of locking up your Ether and there's risk associated with that. So on exchanges, potentially you're going to have two differently traded assets. And then of course there's risk of lockup until phase two goes live. What are your thoughts on the one-way versus a two-way bridge? Of course, a two-way bridge would allow people to send it back to the 1.0 chain. And kind of what are the pros and cons of both of these approaches?
Sure. And I do think that people overestimate the risks of the one-way bridge, basically because especially with the introduction of post-withdrawal transfers that we did in one of the recent versions, like basically if the price of, quote, Beacon Ether ever drops below one Ether, then anyone who wants to become a validator would not do so through the deposit contract mechanism, right? They would do that by depositing a minimum amount of one Ether, and then they would buy the other 31 Ether at a discount off the market, and then they would transfer that into their validator slot and become a validator that way. So as long as there is a net positive pool of people willing to become validators, the price of Beacon Ether is like basically pegged to one Ether through the market mechanism. So like basically, I don't expect the risk between the two being to be that large. But and if people kind of want those risks to comfortably drop to zero, then a two-way bridge is obviously the way to do it. In terms of a two-way bridge, one of the main challenges of that is basically just the viability of verifying the ETH2 chain inside of the ETH1 chain. And one of the things that recently has happened that could potentially make it significantly easier is that there's a lot of work on a ETH2 light client that could be implemented inside of the ETH1 chain. So there's this ETH2 light client protocol that I've recently written a pull request for. It's number 766. And basically, it's like actually really efficient. It's about 80 kilobytes every 9 days to download and verify a new committee, and then you just 500 bytes to verify any block header you want from there. And if we implement BLS 12381 as a precompile inside of the ETH 1.0 chain, then that would allow you to make a light client of the ETH 2 chain as a smart contract inside of the ETH 1 chain, which is really cool. And that would allow you to basically verify ETH 2 blocks inside of the ETH 1 side and then create... modify the deposit contract through a hard fork so that instead of the ETH being permanently stuck in the deposit contract could itself introduce some receipt mechanism so that money could flow back in the other direction. So if people want that sort of thing, it's theoretically implementable. And honestly, it might not even be necessary to implement because like just the possibility that such a thing could be done if people wants to is itself probably... or will itself do quite a bit to kind of add confidence to the to the assets that are on the ETH 2.0 chain in the meantime. But like, if it needs to be done, there's definitely a way to do it.
Gotcha. Yeah, that's interesting. I'm personally a fan of the one-way bridge because I think in phase zero and one, it's more important to have steady deposits and security. And the second you kind of open up that two-way bridge, you could have, you know, people flocking out of the 2.0 chain back to one, and then the security of the network's kind of up and down. So I'm personally a fan, but I know that there's some concerns out there and they're definitely valid. And it'll be interesting to see these two different assets being traded. So in phase two, we're talking about state transitions at that point. I've seen a couple different options out there for how to migrate the ETH 1.0 chain to ETH 2.0. The original idea was to just take the state of the ETH 1.0 chain as a whole and put it into a shard. Is that still the plan, or what's your favorite proposal at this point?
I'd say it's still one of my favorite proposals. And it also depends on how much effort we're willing to put into it. Like, in my opinion, the clean thing to do is definitely to like basically at some point shut the proof of work chain down and turn it into a contract like written in eWASM, which just verifies Merkle proofs of ETH1 state transitions. If we're too lazy to go all the way in doing that, then we'd basically end up keeping the proof of work chain running for a while. And then like at some point, you'd probably want to kind of eventually cut the umbilical cord, and then it would... like either die off or continue as its own chain somehow, but that's like a deadline that would only happen many years in the future. And otherwise, like basically the main challenge with keeping the proof of the 1.0 chain on forever, I mean, aside from the fact that it just adds that it adds validator complexity that we eventually want to get rid of, is that there's also this proof of work reward. And I think people are not going to be willing to keep on paying the proof of work reward while there's this perfectly good proof of stake system that people are already using. Like, it depends. Like, I see it being a contract as one viable possibility. I see it kind of sticking around for a while until either it becomes a contract or it just kind of falls away as being another possibility. But it's definitely, figuring this out is definitely not urgent, though.
Yeah, I agreed with that. It'll be interesting to see how long the 1.0 chain sticks around, but I agree. I think once 2.0 is live and steady and people see the benefits of it, then the transition might happen pretty faster than people are envisioning at this point. I guess my last question on proof of stake, I see a lot of people out there, you know, proof of stake, oh, people that have a lot of coins are able to manipulate that chain and it becomes, the whales are controlling that at a point. How do you respond to that? And, you know, sure, there's a lot of whales out there that are going to stake, but if someone tries to control the network on proof of stake versus, say, a proof of work chain, what are the mitigations that we have to go against that?
To go against someone trying to, like, 51% attack a proof of stake chain, essentially?
Correct. Yeah. If someone were to buy up a decent amount of Ether, say, and try to attack that way.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the most likely thing is probably not someone buying up millions of Ether because that's crazy expensive, but someone basically hacking into an exchange. The reason why that's risky is because, like, if you have 10 million ETH that you just hacked from an exchange, that doesn't actually translate into 10 million ETH of profit for you because there's just no way that you could actually get all of that money out for yourself and get away with it. But, what would you use it for other than just launching 51% attacks for the fun of it? The general way to do this or to recover from 51% attacks, like, first of all, it depends what kind of attack. So, for example, like, finality reversions are actually the thing I'm not that scared about because they're fairly easy to recover from. Like, if you have a finality reversion, then you just kind of socially agree that, oh, this chain was finalized first, and so that chain should count as the chain, even though there is this other chain that it also got created on the side that has 51% support. If it is a 51% censorship attack, then the way out is basically what we call a minority soft fork, where basically the honest validators just agree that, oh, that chain over there is not as acting in a Byzantine way, and so we're just going to go off and build our own chain. So it is a process that would require kind of heavy community handholding, but it is something that can be basically done. Like, it basically just is a kind of user-activated soft fork. And if that happens, then it'll happen, and it's very expensive for whoever actually tried to do that 51% attack.
Gotcha. Yeah, I mean, that's in proof of stake, the attacks can be very costly for very different than proof of work, where they can keep their mining power, right? But in proof of stake, potentially you could be slashed or you could be forked out of the network and you burn a lot of funds, right?
Yeah, I guess, I mean, I use the word spawn camping attack for, like, this idea that if you actually have 51% of a hardware on a proof of work chain, you can just pretty much keep attacking it forever. And, like, yeah, you can't spawn camp proof of stake in the same way.
Yeah, that's a really, really good way to put it, actually. I like that. So I think that's a good background, you know, on, let's say, ETH 1.0 and 1.x and 2.0. So I want to just shift a little bit more into some more general questions. And my first is on privacy. I personally think in order to go mainstream, especially when we're talking about, you know, peer-to-peer transactions and the open finance movement, I don't think we're going to hit mainstream adoption until we have some kind of privacy, right? I always give the example on the podcast, like, I can't even give out a wallet address that I've touched before with my real addresses, or people can, like, dox me, right, financially. And I'm sure, you know, you of all people have that concern as well. How do you currently view privacy on Ethereum? Do you think that we should build this or talk about building it into the protocol itself? Or do you think this can be done on a layer two solution?
I definitely don't think we need to build it into layer one. The reason basically being that, like, first of all, there's a lot of different privacy schemes, and I feel like Ethereum is distinguishing itself by kind of being a programming platform that's open to all of them. And they have different trade-offs. Some of them involve weird cryptographic assumptions. Some of them involve trusted setups. Some of them involve 100 kilobytes of overhead for every transaction. So I don't want to force that choice on people. But in terms of privacy, like at some kind of layer two, I definitely think it's very important. I don't know if you saw, but a few weeks ago, I opened up a thread on magicians that basically was literally called like Meta, we should value privacy more. And I advocated for like basically two things. One of them is a change to wallets, where wallets would by default generate a different address for every dApp that you interact with, so that your activity in different dApps doesn't automatically all get links to each other. And the second thing I advocated is like a proper mixer, so that you can at least send ETH to different applications to pay gas without you sending ETH becoming a de-anonymization vector. So I definitely support that sort of stuff.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of the for different dApps idea. I mean, I have like so many, every dApp I use nowadays, I pretty much just create a new wallet because it's just easier, right? Like you don't want to have to cross, the second you touch a wallet with an old one, all of a sudden you can trace back a whole history of things. So I truly believe this is really important. I mean, of course, like there's ways to get ideas from Zcash and ZK Snarks and Starks and a lot of good works being done there. But I think this is important. I mean, if you kind of showed the open finance movement to someone that's not familiar with it, I think the first thing they would kind of identify besides some of the UX issues is, hey, wait, you can see all my financial transactions. Like that's not going to work, right? So I think this should be a big focus of the community.
Yep. No, the open and open finance is definitely not meant to stand for anyone can machine analyze my data and figure out when I'm pregnant.
Exactly. Yeah. It's the reach of it. It can't be, there's no privacy at all. I fully agree with that. All right, Vitalik. Well, really appreciate you joining the podcast. I think this has been a great conversation and really appreciate it.
Sure. No, thank you. It's it was great to be on here.
Thanks for listening to the Into the Ether podcast. You can subscribe to us at podcast.ethub.io, as well as follow us on Twitter at econoar and at Zazzle0x.